Welcome, everyone. Tonight is the second talk in the series of infusing love in our meditation and what that looks like, because it's really one way to conceive it or perceive the practice of meditation is that we are we start with love of self, love for self. And that in itself is such a radical teaching to many of us. But we just start with love for self, to discover love without self, to discover love on its own, free of the mooring of self. And so wherever we are in that continuum, the word love has something to say to us. We might say that we love ourselves to death, is the meditation, as the course of how the meditation works on us. Let's not be too dramatic with that phrase, but in essence, that's what it does. And how else could we die? How else would we die? How else would we allow ourselves to die? Except through that power, of that grace, really, because it's not coming from us. From the willingness to perceive and reconnect again and again. Because once we allow this power of love to be unleashed, and it will, if you incline your mind towards it, we have to be willing to incline our mind towards it. That's all that's asked of you, really. And then the power of that will be unleashed. And then it's unremitting. It's not a gentle visitor. Not in the sense that it tries to protect or defend us. It exposes us. That's the power of what it does. Is where we have feared to go, it knows we are safe in going. And therefore, it's willing to show us things that we may not be willing to see. And so part of the unleashing of this power within, I suddenly heard myself speaking. I don't sound like a Buddhist at all. I sound like some like Maharaji or something. I'll come back in. So this power, I really, as I was sitting, thoughts occurred to me about how this ignites us as a Sangha, and that there are different layers of how this power begins to infuse and burn within us like a bonfire, really. We get on fire. I mean, when we hear about being on fire, it's really almost a literal truth inwardly of the expression, energetic expression of what this does. It sets us aflame. But what the Sangha does to encourage that burning, the crescendo of that fire, is that we invest ourselves in the Dharma through the Sangha. We get excited about making it our own. We're not coming here for me. I have a place to play in the Sangha. I have no questions about that, but this is about your own fire and finding your place in the Sangha and in the Dharma, where the Dharma attracts you to with such a pull, with such an intensity, with such a gravitational pull that you want it to be your own. You want to become a fire walker, not a fire observer. You don't want to sit by the fire. It's not Christmas Eve where we're roasting marshmallows. You want to dance within the flames. And by investing in the product of the Sangha, by making it your own, that is how this begins to burn and work within each one of us. And if you are too passive in this, there can be a lull in our inner engagement, of our full frontal engagement in the Dharma. And that law often that passivity often represents a huge enemy of love. And tonight I'm talking about kindness and its near enemies. Kindness and its near enemies. And that sort of hesitation of, I want to stay safe. I just want to come and listen. And I don't want to become too enthusiastic. Because that sort of upsets the apple cart of my life. Well, we can play like that for a while. We can do that. But eventually it demands much more from us than that. Much more than complacency. Much more than sort of making sure our home is nice and neat and tucked in, and we then excursion out from the home to a Dharma talk and come back into our safety of our life as we can live it. It needs more of us than that. And the Sangha is often a fuse towards that end. And I don't think some of us quite understand that, because I feel a passivity. But that passivity may be because, if we look at our life, and if you're passive in the Sangha, are you complacent in your life in general? Is there a sort of resting in general, that, fine, you can do that for 70 years, but then you're going to die. We are going to die. What has that passivity done? What is the, you see, it requires something else from us. The Dharma requires something else. And sometimes that gets mislaid and misrepresented around a person, but it's never around the person. It's around your own fire in your own heart. And the way that manifests in interpersonal relationships and intrapersonally is through kindness. Kindness. You see, the brightness and vitality of a fire settles into a gentle and sensitive approach to life as we live it individually and interpersonally and intrapersonally. And so it's not like the flames are always like some, you know, like a Rumi poem, you know, an ecstatic. It's not always ecstatic, although it can many times be that way. But it's the unstoppable quality of the heart that relentlessly perceives and approaches life through kindness. And it's through kindness that we are transformed. It's so interesting. Because believe me, I tried it the other way. I tried it through brutality. Why not? And it didn't work very successfully for me. You're welcome to venture that course if you are insane, but I wouldn't advise it. I mean, just that the muscle of the mind approach to Dharma practice. You know that one? Where we can become so self-determined and so disciplined inwardly that we are holding ourselves in kind of a tight, white-knuckled, fisted approach to practice. Or perhaps that isn't your style. It was my style, and I had to burn out from that style. I was going to make this work come hell or high water, and hell or high water came. So that's one approach, but the other approach is through passivity, where we don't allow it, we don't even offer energetically what it's asking of us because we're afraid to fail. Or we don't want to risk. And either side of that equation needs to be infused with love, with kindness. Because near enemies of love near enemies of kindness, righteous indignation, or self-indulgence. See, it's interesting, isn't it? Self-indulgence is, I mean, that's what we've created mostly in terms of what this country is, a self-indulgent country, I'm sorry to say. And we are adamant about protecting our comforts, and the rest of the world be damned. And our practice follows suit from that enculturation. There's no way it can't. And so we sit down and we look for the indulgent way towards transformation. And the indulgent way towards transformation is, I just received an email from a friend we've had dialogues along the way, and you know, I've often said that you're more interested in comfort than you are in transformation, and he admits to that. But so he sends me emails, and this last email, it was about something called, I can't remember, something called Whole Effects or something. Anyway, it's this tape that you buy that is sort of the white noise behind your meditation. So you sit with this, and it's supposed to bring you into the rhythms of certain alpha or theta rhythms. I don't know, whatever the rhythms are that make your mind harmonious, those are the rhythms of this tape. And he was saying, why don't you just hand out tapes instead of all this hard work? Why not do it that way? And I thought, well, that's interesting, because, you know, I'm sure that those tapes are selling quite nicely in this culture, because it's the indulgent way towards meditation. Meditation has nothing to do with establishing theta or alpha or beta rhythms. It does have nothing, zero. Okay, zero. If those establish themselves, fine, within the meditation, and perhaps quite naturally they will. But to hold on to those as the product of meditation is self-indulgence. We are looking at our relationship to whatever is going on, including the alphas and the betas and the other rhythms that aren't so attractive. How are we when our life is in chaos? How are we when we're in the midst of difficulty? How are we in difficulty? Because if we're not comfortable in difficulty, if we don't understand the need to move into difficulty, we will never understand kindness. Never. Kindness is fed through difficulty. Kindness is learned through difficulty. And to skirt it, because somehow it doesn't fit the indulgence of what we really want out of our meditation, is to limit our meditation to the doldrums. You see the courage that's necessary? You see the inflamed courage that's necessary in this? Because love, once it's unleashed, and I want to read this Buddha passage, as I read often to you, but it's just one of my favorites. He says, in this way we will train ourselves by liberation of the self through love. We will develop love. We will practice love. We will make it both a ways and a basis. Take our stand upon it, store it up, and thoroughly set it going. There's no out. You see? And once love is unleashed with that degree of courage, the courage that he's talking about, just tearing down the fences, then it seeks out those areas in where we have been contracted. Makes sense, doesn't it? It goes after itself. It knows that all things are of its own nature. And so like a dog, it sniffs out those places where we don't believe that love exists, which is the contracted, difficult, reactive areas of ourselves, where we are so self-intoned and infused that we see no love there. You know those areas? But love, unleashed, goes there straight forward. No, it doesn't circumnavigate it. And it transforms that. Unrelenting, it transforms the incrustation, the contraction, back into matters of the heart. But if we're interested in self-indulgence, we're interested in circumnavigating those difficulties and finding a way out of them. We don't want any part of them. And so love stays partial. It stays contained. It stays isolated from the islands of our pain. And so when we understand the chemistry of this thing, when we understand that chemistry, then we just, then we just open, that's it, just to swan dive, an open-hearted swan dive. And, but we have so much adverse conditioning to that kind of gentleness. We poo-poo it. Oh, this is getting too new agey. Or just watch how our minds even open to the word kindness or love. For some of us, there's no resonance even with the word. We're that far distant to it. It has no access, no way in, because we keep belittling the possibility. But once unleashed, it asks its own questions, doggedly determined to end all limitations. Doggedly determined. What is this? What is this pain? What is this thing? Is there love for this too? Where's kindness in this moment? The vocabulary of transformation has to do with love trying to invest itself into the difficult, into the contracted. And many of us, like myself, get involved in methods that are self-determined methods, which are meant to keep love out. And sometimes those methods can be so brutal because we feel so unqualified for the sacred that we will practice the methods in order to do penance so that we can become sufficiently open to ourselves so that we are qualified for love. But whatever methods we're practicing, we can infuse it, the methodology, the intentionality of keeping ourselves in charge, keeping the difficult at bay, and keeping ourselves in charge, which will delay the transformation that's inevitable once this fire has been started in us. It's going to burn us all, but some of us can make it lasts a long time before that happens. There are so many ways to get lost in this practice, but there's only one way to get found. And that way is kindness. Tender. It's interesting, you know, because it's so obvious that the way of love is exposure. I mean, It's not insulation. Everybody, you can just hear it in the words. I mean, if we just used our practical sense, that the more contracted we become, the more isolated, the more distant, the more separate, the more aloof, the less we are in touch with love. The more open, the more affected, the more tender, the more sensitive, the more connected. So it's so obvious, isn't it? So how are your practice following those principles? How are our practice following those principles? But a teacher told me that, you know, we stay far too long in methodologies that keep us so remote to the possibilities of the true touch of kindness, the true inclination. What we're asking for is an inclination of the mind, not an effort. Your efforts, you are not involved in your kindness and love. You have to stay out of it. This is a cake that makes itself. But you can ruin it. Right? When I was 12, I thought I knew what to put into a cake. I didn't. So we begin just to turn it over. But turning it over feels powerless, but then love feels powerless, really. I mean, it's not something that is going to intone much self-adulation because it happens on its own. You can't claim self-reference for it. In fact, when you do, love comes at you with it. That's the very thing it's trying to uproot. Because wherever we're self-referencing, we're fixed. And love, if it means anything, is being unfixed. How can we be fixed in love? The definition, that's an oxymoron. And so the willingness to incline one's mind, in other words, intentionality, which is a word that you'll hear from me as long as you stay in Sims a number of times, because when we are willing to give up our efforts towards something, and may I say that, you know, it's not that metta and practices like that don't have purposes in the meditation. They offset a huge predisposed way of looking at ourselves, which is often very held in unkindness. And they begin to allow the heart to come out and to reconsider relationships with through judgments, so that the relationship of re-establishing relationship and looking again is really what metta is trying to do. It's to reconsider what we have judged the world to be so that we can allow the world to get into us again. And metta is a wonderful avenue for that dispensation. But ultimately, what we're really doing is relaxing the heart from the opinions that have held it at bay and re-exposing ourselves vulnerably once more to life. That's what all of these practices are meant to do. And then to feel the vulnerability without flinching. That's the hard part. There's the rub. Because vulnerability is the last thing that a human being, me, wants to feel. It wants to feel empowered. It doesn't want to feel vulnerable. It doesn't want to feel raw. It doesn't want to feel exposed. We want to pass by all of that and get to the safety of our own empowerment. And so we'll only give out so many dollars to real change before we stop seeing the people on the sidewalk. Until there's a compassion burnout. Enough's enough, we'll say. Enough's enough. Enough is not enough. There is no enough in kindness. There is no enough in kindness. There are times when we have to take ourselves out of the tsunami wave of the pain because it's just overbearing. It's too much for us, which is fine. This is consciously backing off and allowing ourselves to renew our psychic posture to things. There's nothing wrong with that. In fact, I would recommend that. But then we know what we're doing and we march right back out. That's why having social engaged activity, so that we're always up against the limitations of ourselves in practice and in society through those engaged activities. It can be with the dying, the homeless, doesn't matter, wherever one naturally alights. Can be very helpful, can be very helpful in opening and feeding and reinforcing the way of the heart. I was a Theravada nun came over and visited me yesterday in the house, and she's been a nun for a couple of years. She spent about 18 months in Burma with a very strict and disciplined teacher that many of us here have practiced with, Upandita, and she in everyone's practice, there's just the swings of energy towards that kind of intensity and swings away. And she was kind of self-reprimanding herself because she didn't feel like sitting, and she didn't think of herself as being serious anymore because she wasn't holding herself to the fire of that level of the intense practice. And I said, those come and go. Everyone's practice is going to feel at times like you've lost it, like it's not there anymore. You're going to look around and say, that was great, but now I don't feel like it's even with me anymore. But that, let us, instead of believing that, which is believing in our doubt, just arrest for a moment. Just rest for a moment. Just relax into that belief, into that particular story. Just release the tension surrounding that story. In other words, embrace the story. Embrace how I'm feeling in this moment, instead of making it a determinant for the disposition of my practice. What if I just relaxed in this for this moment? And we did that together. And she said, wow, here it is. There it is. Here it is. It's back. Never having left. Because what happens in that moment is the call of love. And we can be so self-brutal in the practice work in a certain way through that brutality. Yes, you will find your ability to stay on your nose tip longer. You'll find that certain experiences will happen, fireworks. But if you wait for July 4th, it'll happen anyway. Yes, you will have those experiences, but where's the kindness? Where's the basis of what we're doing? Where's the heart on what we're doing? And you'll feel accomplished. And you'll feel like, well, I've had this experience and I've progressed, and you might have a whole, like, topography of where you are in your map of things. But where's the love? Only a small thing missing, called everything. We can't get away with that. Because this isn't self-made. That's the beauty. That's the aliveness. That's where life comes from. If it came from our determination and willful volition, well, we would all be very much alive, wouldn't we, in our lives? Because that's what has been leading the adventure of life for most of us. But what if we relaxed that? What if we tested the waters of love, of kindness? It's not just, okay, I'm going to incline my mind towards love. I'm just going to sample the waters of it. The tender waters of it. And those, the clarity of that will show me everything. I have absolute faith in that. Whether I'm willing to look, that's my own inward disposition and difficulty. I have to work with that. That's what I have to sort of splash cold water on my face and realize what love is showing me and say, am I going to open my eyes to that or not? And sometimes it's like, I don't know. And then if I wait long enough, I do. That's what happens to me. That's my way. It may take me a long time or not so long, but I will open my eyes to it. And that's all that counts. Because that's all that's necessary. It's not like we have to go through this whole writhing motion of pain and being freaked out and just a sense of self-vengeance and nothing like that. It's just opening our eyes. Going to keep our eyes closed? Okay. Because love doesn't care. Love doesn't care if you keep your eyes closed or keep your eyes, because it's going to keep shining. And at some point, you're going to have to open your eyes to take a step. And when you do, there it is, and there you go. And now it's done. Was that so bad? Was that so bad, people? That we have to defend and deny and reject and turn away and refuse and belittle? Was it really so bad? Or are those just the addicts of eyes closed tightly? And so we get very interested in where the enemies, the near enemies of love and kindness are located. Like indulgence, you see, the same act that we do from kindness can also be an act of indulgence. And who knows, for instance, we didn't get enough sleep at night. We lie in bed and the alarm goes off. We shut the alarm off and continue to sleep because the body needs more rest. That is an act of kindness. Same person, different situation where you've got plenty of sleep. The alarm goes off and you just don't want to get up. You shut the alarm off and that's indulgence. Somebody from the outside looking at you doesn't know the difference. Inside, we know the difference. We know the difference between indulgence and kindness. Kindness is unremitting. It will not take us to the comfortable. It's not afraid of the comfortable, but it doesn't drive everything through that channel. Indulgence does. Kindness is willing to move right into the difficult because it realizes that the kind thing to do for us is to expose that difficulty to kindness. Remember, it's love is the action necessary for difficulty to dissolve. So we base ourselves in love, as the Buddha said. We make it both a way and a basis. Take our stand upon it, store it up, and thoroughly set it going. We turn ourselves over to it. And we know, that's the thing. You see, I mean, one of the basic teachings is just do what you know. And we know whether we're being indulgent or not. Whether we're going to listen to what we know, I don't know. But we do know that. And we get very discriminating to the voices of love and the voices of indulgence. But see, most of us, because we're afraid of love, want to be in proximity to love, but not throw ourselves into the fire. So we do what's a near enemy in presentation, in style, which is called being nice. Smiling, being friendly. I'm saying it in a disparagingly. It's nothing wrong with being nice. I'd rather have nice neighbors than not nice neighbors. But where we're going with this, we need to see the difference. We need to be able to discern the difference, discriminate the difference. And niceness is a presentation. It's an egoic role. It's based on appearance. She's such a nice person. Right? My teacher, Ajahn Buddhadasa, I would never characterize. I mean, he was kind of like a grump. But he never turned anyone away. He was like, open, come, everyone come. It was love in a disguise. But he never lost patience. Never, really. He's quite an amazing man. Once you get over the hurdle of expecting a certain presentation, the notes I get sometimes from some of you are like, why don't you change your presentation, Rodney? You get what you get here. I'm not going to become inauthentic based upon your need. And you're welcome just not to come if it doesn't fit you. To be authentic. I've inclined my mind in that way. And I have faith that however it's presented, there will not be a motivation of harm. Now meet me in that inclination. And then we have something to talk about. But if you're looking at style points, you're not going to find them, probably from you or from me. Can the me be kind? Can I be kind? No. The embodiment of me is the lack of kindness. Isn't that interesting? See, when the me takes up being kind, I'm going to be kind now, it starts measuring how kind it is, doesn't it? And then it won't allow itself to be, it needs to keep moving forward in kindness, or it feels like it's not being kind, and I wasn't as kind yesterday as I was the day before, and therefore I'm losing my kindness, and it becomes a kind of prized possession, kindness. If we start evaluating our presentation based upon what we think is an expression of kindness. One of the most difficult things it is, because we harbor so much self-dislike, is to even realize when we are kind. Most of us don't even give ourselves credit for the kindness when it does manifest. Because we don't hold ourselves in that light. We don't think that we're capable. That's not the image we think of when we think of ourselves. And yet, if we look during the course of the day, many, many things we do are out of kindness. And yet behind this is kind of the white disturbance noise of our self-belittlement, which will never allow the recognition of a kind act. Start recognizing when you are kind. Not holding yourself to some kind of evaluation of that fact, but just observing it. Oh, okay. The ability to listen to someone. Small things. We're not talking about, you know, making monuments here. Offering a cup of tea, letting somebody pass in front of us, saying hello, not dismissing someone, attention that we can offer someone. Not reacting to some of our emotional states. Because kindness, when we allow itself to be inclusive, to feel, to have an inward life of its own, free of our evaluation and determination and comparison of how kind we are, when the mind releases the need for the me to express and show itself in kindness by being so sweet and nice to everybody, when we can relax with this thing, kindness takes off. Beyond the range of effort. Inclusive. Never separate. Always inclusive. Able to say no, yes. Set boundaries. Because self-kindness wants to know what. It wants to pull the stakes out from any limitation. It wants to uproot limitation. And it does so with the only way that limitations could ever be dissolved, through kindness. Not through judgment. Not through belittlement. Not through willful effort. But just life coming back in on itself. Kindness coming back to itself. Making it all whole. Wholly kind. Doesn't that make sense? Doesn't it somehow feel, oh, right, of course. What have I been doing? Sometimes we need that kind of inward shake. Oh, God, what have I been doing? To set our course and our path with a clear intention. Thank you all. Can we sit for just a minute or two? So as we sit, are we sitting kindly towards ourselves? Where if there is irritation, it's known. And when something is known, it's kindness that knows itself. It's not you that knows it. Kindness is the only thing that can know itself. So when something is known, it's kindness that's looking. And the quieter you become, the more kindness sees itself. So if there are any questions or comments about anything, I'd be happy to respond if I can. Yes. Yes, sir.
I'm curious about a sort of seeming contradiction. When you talk about the fire, the enthusiasm, and it feels energetically quite different than a sort of detached kind of equanimity. And I don't know if that's a contradiction.
It's a contradiction. I don't relate at all to detached equanimity. Those words are so distant to my concept of spirituality that I just can't even relate to that. And I say that because we develop our imprints, our path, and in the direction we're taking from some theoretical concept that we might have heard, like detached equanimity. What does that mean? Well, the way my mind interprets that is to be distant and aloof and to have a non-feeling relationship to what it is that's being seen or lived, which is exactly opposite to kindness. Kindness is a full body, full embodiment of life. Now, you do hear equanimity, but you won't hear it very often from me. And when you do hear it from me, it's an explanation like this, in which I suggest that instead of using equanimity, because equanimity is a kind of way that we take a step back and say, now am I being equanimous here? Which is the wrong way to do that. You flow yourself into the fire and let everything just be aflamed and learn what you can during that. And what comes out from that learning will be non-reactive. Well, you start feeling safer with the mind than you felt with it before the reaction began. And with that safety, with the ability to feel safe in the mind, in the working of the mind, you will be settled within the mind. There will be settledness. You won't be. There will be settledness within the mind. There won't be a sense of having to even develop equanimity because you will see it not as threatening at all. We take the fear out of the thing. We don't take the fear out of us. We take it out of the thing. We see that it's essentially harmless. Taking the fear out of us, we have to go back and to a non-fear space and look at life. If we throw ourselves into life, life will take the fear out of us if we keep the observation open to the observation of it. You see? So that's a very important difference to know. And I say that somewhat passionately, and I apologize for that. But because people do have that fixed notion of equanimity as being somehow a spiritual goal that we are seeking. It is not. No matter what Goenkaji says. Okay? If you'd like to have a Dharma debate, I'd be happy to have a Dharma debate. Yes. I did?
Yeah. First talk or the second this year?
Mathematics and love. I don't remember that. What was my connection?
No, I made a disconnection between the two. You know, you didn't want to, you seem to have a very strong aversion to mathematics for some reason.
I do not have a, let me just interrupt you. I do not have an aversion to mathematics. I don't know what I said that gave you that thought. In fact, I quite enjoy mathematics and science. I absolutely do. So, anything I said that gave a hint that that was not the case just was misunderstood.
Yeah. Well, anyway, a mathematician, when they discover something new, it has to do with, I think, equanimity. That is, you're willing to look at something that that no one else would be.
I don't know what to say to that.
It's a difficult thing. Unless you read,
Okay, you be quiet now, okay? So I'm just going to talk from what you said, all right? Equanimity, he relates to discovering something new and seeing something new and fresh. And the reason that that was discovered, even though after it's discovered, it appears to be so obvious, is because He thinks the person was equanimous when they discovered it. And I would say that the person was open, that the person was interfacing with creativity, was open, wasn't trying to hold on to the fixed ways that he or she perceives the world, and that's why where the creative response comes in. If you want to call that openness or in full embrace of love, equanimity, I will agree. No, you're finished now. Okay? But if you don't, if you want to argue that it's a composed state of mind, then I will come to task with that, because openness is not a contrived state of mind. It's the absence of contrived quality. It's the willingness to look beyond what is known into the unknown and interface with the unknown. If interfacing with the unknown is what we call equanimity, then so be it. But that's not how most people define equanimity. So enough of equanimity. Other questions? Yes. 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 The difficulty in knowing the difference between kindness and indulgence. You know, it is very difficult at first to know that difference. Look to the motivation of why you're doing something. What's your intention in doing what you're doing? And if it's towards being more comfortable, then you might want to question whether, in fact, it's kind. Now, it doesn't mean that sometimes kindness doesn't have that as its goal. Sometimes we need to be comfortable. Sometimes we've had such a hard day that to come in and just be comfortable is exactly the right thing to do. But it's based upon the need and balanced perception of life rather than just seeking out what is comfortable all the time, regardless of what our day has been like. Do you see? So we have to find our way through this. It's almost, we do it in Braille. I can give some indication of how we can stumble along, but we're going to make a lot of mistakes in this thing, like everything else. But those each mistake we make teaches us to be in a more sensitive way to what it means to be kind and what it means to be indulgent. So don't be afraid of making mistakes. Just give yourself over to that and be assured that if you stay fine-tuned, like on a TV set, you're tuning the channel more and more crisp each day that you live with the subject matter, that you'll be able to discern this at some point very clearly. So I have to stop the questions.